This episode of the Living Poetry Podcast was recorded on the 3rd of December, 2011. My name is Bartholomew Barker, and I'm joined by Tara Lindgren, Pamela Taylor, and Angelica Toiber. We're the organizers of Living Poetry, a collection of poets and poetry readers in the Raleigh-Durham metropolitan area of North Carolina. Check out livingpoetry.net, search for Living Poetry on Facebook, and if you reside in the Piedmont, join our Living Poetry meetup group. We're going to be talking about dead poets local, poets from North Carolina or have some association with North Carolina, no matter how tenuous.
We have to talk about George Moses Horton. Yes.
I have the book The Black Poet, again by Richard Walzer. I might have said Robert before, it's Richard Walzer. And it's called the Remarkable Story, Partly Told by himself, of George Moses Horton, a North Carolina slave. And I think that's one of the most intriguing parts about him, is that as a slave, he learned to read and write, which was in some places forbidden. And he was very well known for his poetry and his writing. And he had many, what do they call, sponsors. Because of his talent. And he eventually did go up to gain his freedom and move up to Philadelphia. But it was very interesting because in Philadelphia, nobody really knew him. And so he was like, it was a very different scene for him, because in North Carolina, everybody knew him as a poet. Everybody gave him his respect. Even though he was still a slave, still not a free person, he felt like he had more respect, as a slave in North Carolina than he did, being a free man in Philadelphia. And he, at the end of his life, he comes back down to North Carolina. So he actually died in North Carolina, even though he was a free man. He returned to North Carolina because he felt like he was more respected and down here than he was up there.
Yeah, Mr. Horton was a slave. He was born in the very end of the 18th century. And then his owner moved to Chatham County, outside of Pittsburgh. And so he worked on a farm there. But like on the weekends, he would walk 8 miles up to Chapel Hill to the university and sell fruit and poems. He was essentially doing poetry on demand.
No, yes. He was not. Really?
He was.
Yes.
How cool
like
is that?
For 25 cents or 50
oh
cents, he would write a poem for
oh,
the
wow.
for the
we
students.
Need to charge more.
I know.
He was charging 25 cents back then.
Exactly. We got to calculate the inflation
I
rate.
Know. It's like $50.
They said, yeah, they said that a student had per month, I think it was $10 to give.
Wow.
And so for them to give up 50 cents for a poem was a lot. What I also thought was interesting was that when he actually realized that this is good money and, it was in demand, he what they called, hired his time out. He would give money to his owner to not have to be on the farm, but to actually be able to spend time at Chapel Hill and make more money. And he would make like $4 or $5 a week. And he hired out his time at 50 cents per week. So you can just imagine.
Wow.
And that was at a time where North Carolina was actually very generous towards slaves. They allowed them a lot. They allowed them to have books and everything. And that did change later. And I thought, too, that was interesting that he survived as a poet from going to being able to express his anti-slavery opinions in a time that was when North Carolina was fairly liberal. But then 30 years in, with the uprisings and the killings on both sides, that the atmosphere in North Carolina changed, and actually the publication of anti-slavery was forbidden. And so he moved his poetry slightly into non-political
mm-hmm.
arena
right.
and still survived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to just stay on the same level of reputation and being in demand in such a shift of culture,
yeah.
I thought was very impressive.
It's very interesting because there's a point where he talks about how there's dislike both on the white and black side of him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So some of the blacks don't feel like he's doing enough, you know, some of them he's doing too much, so he's sort of like caught in that, in the middle of that, you know?
Mm.
Very interesting.
I thought it was interesting that he got into literature by having books donated to him. So that's how he started to learn to read. He didn't actually write for a long time, but he knew how to read. His vocabulary was phenomenal for a slave. And when you said, you know, poetry on demand, basically what my book said, which was written by Joan R. Sharman, she's also a local researcher of, I think, African-American literature in North Carolina. She said that during the week at the plow, he would think about things to say and, you know, like it was mostly poems ordered by guys for the sweetheart. So he would like contemplate topics and what to say and what to compare them to. And then when he would go on the weekend to Chapel Hill, it'd be 25 cents for a little bit of a love poem, 50 cents for a bit more of an outspoken, and then 75 cents for a gushy passion poem. So, you know, the degree of gushiness would actually up the price.
Wow.
I thought that was very interesting.
That's because
yeah.
men don't like their feelings. And then he knew that he could get so much more money. Like, you know, if you really love her, you'd pay 75 cents.
Yes.
I mean, it still works. I still do that too.
Let's read some of his poetry.
I've got The Death of an Old Carriage Horse here. I love the first and the last stanzas. I was a harness horse, constrained to travel weak or strong, with orders from a pressing force, push along, push along. I had no space of rest and took at forks the roughest prong, still by the cruel driver pressed, push along, push along. Vain strove the idle bird to charm me with her artless song, but pleasure lingered from the word, push along, push along. The order of the day was push, the peal of every tongue. The only word was all the way, push along, push along. Thus to my journey's end, had I to travel right or wrong, till death, my sweet and favored friend, bade me from life to push along.
Mm-hmm.
I love all the repetition. And, you know, just thinking, you know, just horses in general, whenever I see them, like, pulling a carriage or, you know, anything like that. It's just, it seems so unnatural that they should be kind of being free and wild and, you know, having to just push through the days and then again they'll be pushed into death, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just keep going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, I'm sure it had an extra meaning too.
Yes, it
mm-hmm.
did. Mm-hmm.
I like, this is actually a style of his to repeat,
mm-hmm.
to make the last line repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. It has a song feel
yeah,
to it.
Absolutely.
It's probably what throughout the day if he's going to be thinking
yes.
of poems, it makes him easy
yes.
to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And plus,
mm-hmm.
I guess it falls, if you have a song in your head, you fall into a certain step,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to do a lot of repetitive work, so
mm-hmm.
kind of like that helped them to stay in a rhythm and get through the day as well.
Yeah.
I have one that's, it is a slavery poem, but it also has sort of that fourth line be the same word here. It's called The Slave's Complaint. Am I sadly cast aside on misfortune's rugged tide? Will the world my pains deride forever? Must I dwell in slavery's night and all pleasure take its flight far beyond my feeble sight forever? Worst of all, must hope grow dim and withhold her cheering beam? Rather let me sleep and dream forever. Something still my heart surveys, groping through the dreary maze. Is it hope? Then burn and blaze forever. Leave me not a wretch confined, altogether lame and blind, unto gross despair consigned forever. Heaven, in whom I can confide. Canst thou not for all provide? Condescend to be my guide forever. And when this transient life shall end, oh, may some kind eternal friend bid me from servitude ascend forever. Yes, even though he's complaining obviously about bondage, he's still doing it, I find, in a not very accusatory way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very gentle way to object to a life in bondage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting that in the last line he's like, oh, may some kind eternal friend bid me from servitude ascend forever. So the whole belief, or, you know, that you didn't know if you would, the whole idea of freedom was just so, such a faraway thing,
mm-hmm.
that you could only be free if you died.
Died, yeah.
You know? That's still there.
This is one of the ones that you wrote for a student, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also an acrostic, which is what he used to
mm-hmm.
do a lot of for the guys. So he would take the woman's name and make that to be the first letters of the lines. So this one is for a Mary McLean. And I'm guessing it was done for a Mr. Torrance. May this inspired acrostic prove a perfect token of my love. Return thy torch almost expired, yet find by whom thou art admired. My soul of love would fly to thee, constrained thy winning form to see. Like Pan, whose destiny was grief, exploring nature for relief, and sure when thee my love has found, naught else in life can heal the wound. When on the constellations I cast my eyes afar, I can tell my Bonnie Belle, the queen of every star. When I look from the mountain or nature's lofty tower, then I can tell my Bonnie Belle, the queen of every flower. When gazing from the window on blooms both low and tall, then I can tell my charming Belle, the fairest one of all.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right?
I hope he got 75 cents.
I know. I've got another one. It doesn't have the name of it, but I think it was one that it says published in a Southern Literary Messenger, and it's again a love poem. I would be thine when morning breaks on my enraptured view, when every star her tower forsakes, and every tuneful bird awakes and bids the night adieu. I would be thine when Phoebus speeds his chariot up to the sky, or on the heel of night he treads, and through the heavens refulgent spreads, thine would I live or die. I would be thine, thou fairest one, and hold thee as my boon, when full the morning's race is run, and half the fleeting day is gone, thine let me rest at noon. I would be thine when evening's veil or mantles all the plain, when Cynthia smiles on every dale and spreads like thee her nightly sail to dim the starry train. Let me be thine, although I take my exit from this world, and when the heavens the thunder shake and all the wheels of time shall break with globes to nothing hurled, I would be thine.
Mm-hmm. Great one. I almost thought about marking that one up too. Love the word refulgent.
Yes.
He has a good hand for love poems.
Yeah.
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 I like another one by him. It's actually about himself.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is entitled George Moses Horton, comma myself. I feel myself in need of the inspiring strains of ancient lore, my heart to lift, my empty mind to feed, and all the world explore. I know that I am old and never can recover what is past, but for the future may some light unfold and soar from age's blast. I feel resolved to try, my wish to prove, my calling to pursue, or mount up from the earth into the sky to show what heaven can do. My genius from a boy has fluttered like a bird within my heart, but could not thus confined her powers employ, impatient to depart. She, like a restless bird, would spread her wing, her power to be unfurled, and let her songs be loudly heard, and dart from world to world. Yeah, so it looks like he is one of those poets that had also the courage to live it, like, that never left him. He never sort of switched, like, you know, professions or calling. And he was actually pretty old. He turned 83, I think, when
he made
it
at least to the
80s, died.
Yeah.
Yes, he, very old at that time.
Yeah, extremely old. For,
yes.
Especially for a man who grew up a slave.
Yes.
Yeah.
And lived, what, 60, over 60 years as a slave.
Yeah.
I love this poem only because I've never heard of a poem written about an itch.
Oh, nice.
Troubling with the itch and rubbing with sulfur. 'Tis bitter, yet 'tis sweet. Scratching affects but transient ease. Pleasure and pain together meet and vanish as they please. My nails, the only balm, to every bump are oft applied, and thus the rage will sweetly calm, which aggravates my hide. It soon returns again, a frown succeeds to every smile. Grinning I scratch and curse the pain, but grieve to be so vile. In fine, I know not which can play the most deceitful game, the devil, sulfur, or the itch. The three are but the same. The devil sows the itch, the sulfur has a loathsome smell, and with my clothes as black as pitch, I stink where'er I dwell. Excoriated deep by friction played on every part, it oft deprives me of my sleep and plagues me to my heart.
He was just having so much fun. That's like, oh my god, let me write about this itch.
Yeah.
So it must have been a really bad itch.
It must have been.
You know, comparing it to the devil and sulfur?
Yeah.
I know.
It must have been a rash. Like,
yeah,
only a
been.
Rash itch is like
right.
that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It's like, the relief is great, but almost, when it comes back, it's almost worse
yes.
you know, than it was before. And also, I think it's the middle school in
Pittsburgh
is named after him,
mm-hmm.
and also has a, I'm not sure if a statue or commemorate plaque that gives information about him. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is something that he actually wrote down from the. I assume the difficult task of writing a concise history of my life, but to open a scene of all the past occurrences of my life, I shall not undertake, since I should fail by more than 2/3 in the matter. But if you will condescend to read it, I will endeavor to give a slight specimen entirely clear of exaggeration. A tedious and prolix detail in the matter may not be of any expected, since there is necessarily so much particularity required in a biographical narrative. Love his language. I was born in Northampton County, North Carolina, near the line of Virginia and within 4 miles of the Roanoke River. The property of William Horton Sr., who also owned my mother, and the whole stock of her children, which were 5 before me, all girls, but not of one father. I am the oldest child that my mother had by her second husband, and she had 4 younger than myself, 1 boy and 3 girls. But to account for my age is beyond the reach of my power.
Wow. That's a great line.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to read one other part about how he sort of came to reading and poetry. And this is him talking about when they moved to Chatham. I here became a cowboy, which I followed for perhaps 10 years in succession or more. In the course of this disagreeable occupation, I became fond of hearing people read, but being nothing but a poor cowboy, I had but little or no thought of ever being able to read or spell one word or sentence in any book whatever. My mother discovered my anxiety for books and strove to encourage my plan, but she, having left her husband behind, was so hard run to make a little shift for herself that she could give no assistance in that case. At length, I took a resolution to learn the alphabet at all events, and lighting by chance at times with some opportunities of being in the presence of school children, I learnt the letters by heart, and fortunately afterwards got hold of some old parts of spelling books abounding with these elements, which I learned with but little difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's, you can just see, like, he really wanted something,
yes,
and he taught himself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So now your book says that he came back to North Carolina at the end of the war?
Yes.
Because this book says they don't know when he died.
This
lady, Joan Sherman, didn't know.
Okay. While it is hard to believe that death was other than welcome to an old man like George Moses Horton, with a life behind him, filled to overflowing with tribulation, adventure, and accomplishment. One cannot be sure that it was so, for the picture is dark, the curtains drawn before the scene. It is not known where or when exactly he made his departure. Perhaps it was not even in Philadelphia. Perhaps, sensing a need for greater than strength, he took the weary highway south where, in accordance with a resolution made upon leaving North Carolina, he breathed out his ultimate moment in familiar surroundings. And then something from him. Let this be chased in my breath, through this and future years to come, my last abode, my final rest, be lodged with thee, my native home.
Hmm.
So it probably is more of a speculation.
Yeah, she doesn't
know.
Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't know either, but that was very interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Doing enough genealogy, I know it's not easy to keep track of people.
Hard. I mean, it's very interesting because I've been trying to do some genealogy for my family, and I've gotten back to my great great grandmother. Yeah, who is
mm-hmm.
a slave. I mean, whose great great grandparents were slaves.
Okay.
And that's all I know because.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have Bibles in which you wrote down, you know, who was born when, that was the way that they did it. People have told me that you need to look at, for particularly if you want to go back to find slaves, you know, it's usually a good bet to go back to try to find the plantation that they were on. Like, for example, Horton was the name of Moses Horton, George Moses Horton's master.
Mm-hmm.
So you just take the name of your master, and in the deeds of the property they would list the slaves as part of the property,
mm-hmm.
so maybe you're lucky to see if somebody
mm-hmm.
took, you know, copious records of all of the
mm-hmm.
the slaves there and who was sold
mm-hmm.
when, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely
mm-hmm. some of the wills would also have it.
Some of the wills would also have it because they would
mm-hmm.
they definitely will the slave to their
mm-hmm.
to their children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what this book talks about.
Mm-hmm.
When Horton Sr. dies,
mm-hmm.
he splits up the slaves amongst his sons.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be lucky to get to the good son, or
right.
you could be
mm-hmm.
unlucky
exactly.
and get to the bad son.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did you tag some more people?
I tag some more people. I'm going to read some women. Because we've been talking about a man. Again, Poets of North Carolina, edited by Richard Walzer. And what I decided to do is, there's a few women in here. It's a book that gives a little bit of a biography and then shows some poems. But I really tried to focus on the people who were born and raised in North Carolina. So I found some females. And this is Edith Earnshaw, and I'll read a little bit of the beginning of her biography. Once, in answer to a question, Edith Earnshaw replied, "I suppose that my greatest achievement was in being born in Wake Forest, North Carolina."
Oh my God.
Which I just like, when I read that, I was like, oh, I just love her already. And so, let's see. She wrote a lot of poems, and this one is kind of long, but I think it's probably, of the ones that I read, one of her best. And it's called Old Chimney. Remote from the broad, humming high road, One morning I happened to spy a chimney without any hearth fire and daffodils blooming close by. The farmhouse, or was it a cabin, had crumbled to dust long ago. The garden, all gone but these blossoms. I suddenly wanted to know who planted the bulbs in the first place, a bride with a dream? Or an old bent granny with work-roughened fingers who treasured her flowers like gold? What pioneer fashioned this chimney that stands here, all timeless and sound? Or does he perchance lie asleep in yon family burial ground? These questions I ask of the breezes. The wind brings no answer to me, but stays in the brooding pine forest, evoking a sound like the sea. I bent down to gather the blossoms, each wistful-eyed gold daffodil, and then changed my mind, lest the chimney should be even lonelier still.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
I was
good.
Like, that was so sweet.
Yes.
Yeah.
What was her age?
Oh, okay. She was the last of six daughters, the seventh, and the eldest was a son of Dr. Charles Elisha Taylor. I can't say if it's no relation. I don't know. President of Wake Forest at the turn of the century. So in 1905, she graduated from Meredith College. And okay. So that was the all-women's college. It actually still is all-women's college.
I think so, yeah.
And then she married Elliot Earnshaw. So this was...
So she was born in the latter part of the 1800s.
The 1800s. And then she died... It says 7 months before her death on July 14th, 1962,
okay.
Versus 1961 was published. So mm-hmm. I think she published her first book before she died.
Hmm.
And so this is Zoe Kincaid Brockman. And she sold a poem at the age of 16. And it was incidentally the year she was married.
Wow.
Interesting.
And what year was she born?
It doesn't say, but she's definitely, I would say, in the early turn of the century.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit later.
So contemporary of Edith.
Yeah, definitely contemporary of Edith. Yeah, because she was born on a farm near Gastonia. And then she took extension courses from the University of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So here she, but the part that I liked about her was... she was instrumental in the organization of the North Carolina Poetry Society back in 1932.
Oh, wow.
So that was really cool
nice.
To read about her.
Yes.
And here's a poem of hers called A Cold Wind Blows. Beloved, there is nothing I can say to make pain less or easier to bear. Our feet are set upon a separate way. We stumbled down a deep, divided stair. Behind us, there are golden days of sun, nights when white magic sailed a sea of blue. Now radiance sinks into oblivion. A cold wind blows between my heart and you. But always, when blue billows wash the sky, always when moonlight spreads an argent sail, I will remember how both you and I strove to withstand a cruel, fateful gale, and how defeated... we went down at last and still must shiver in the eerie blast.
Mm.
So I just really like that because, like, they still
yeah.
didn't stay together, but
mm-hmm.
they fought their best
mm-hmm.
to try. So I like that about her.
Mm.
Another thing about her was that she was the first president of the North Carolina Poetry Society, but also the associate editor of the North Carolina Poetry Review.
Mm-hmm.
So she was very involved in bringing poetry to North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking before we started recording about the three books that I found at the Chapel Hill Library, my home away from home.
They smell good.
I know.
I can smell them from here.
Yeah.
Library books,
like
yeah.
books. So North Carolina Poetry, The Black Poet, which was the George Moses Horton book, and Poets of North Carolina, that were all compiled by Richard Walzer, who actually taught at NC State But he was a huge literary figure in North Carolina and just put together so many books of North Carolina poets and writers and fiction and plays and short stories. Mm. He says, this is his intro to poetry in North Carolina. "Certainly the poetry of any one state is not intrinsically or necessarily different from that of another. Neither trends, styles, nor ideas know state lines. Any politically separated portion of a country, however, may possess certain geographical and historical distinctions which tend to make its literature unique. This is true of North Carolina. We have here a poetry of the coastal plains, of the pine woods, of the mountains." So, I mean, he's setting that up. And then he's talking about, "Nevertheless, the most popular medium for North Carolina poets has always been the lyric, by which are best expressed the love of fireside and folk, the beauties of familiar everyday nature, the loyalty to one's homeland, and the personal outpourings of man's thoughts and feelings." Which I thought, you know, in all the things that I read, that was really, really true of the poetry here.
That concludes this episode of the Living Poetry Podcast. Please visit our website, livingpoetry.net. If you have any comments or questions, please send us an email at podcast@livingpoetry.net. This has been Bartholomew Barker, Tara Lynn Groff, Pamela Taylor, and Angelica Teuber, Living Poetry.
Did you have to be such a guy?
Yes, I do.